What is up, everybody? Dr. Joe Armstrong here, and I am super excited to tell you that we have a sponsor, and that sponsor is Medgene. It's a new day in animal healthcare, and Medgene is wide awake. Medgene is the first USDA-licensed producer of prescription platform vaccines. Medgene's prescription platform vaccines help veterinarians in the swine, cattle, deer, and rabbit industries respond faster and more efficiently. Learn more about Medgene's prescription platform vaccines at MedgeneLabs.com. That's MedgeneLabs.com. Or better yet, follow Medgene on Facebook and LinkedIn. Medgene, it's a new day in animal healthcare. What is up, everybody? This is Dr. Joe Armstrong. It is 6/28/2024 at 10:30 a.m. We've got some updates. We've got one document in particular that we're going to go over in detail, and two documents that we're going to just kind of glance over because we don't have a whole lot of information to report, just some upcoming things that we need to be on the watch for and some details that will need to be sorted out before we really go into any depth. Not worth spending a whole lot of time on them until we have all the information. All right, let's go over the documents we don't have all the details on yet. One of them is a press release from the USDA APHIS saying that they're going to open enrollment for the herd payment plan related to H5N1. If you remember way back, May 23rd, over a month ago, which kind of surprised me, kind of snuck up on me that it had been that long, they announced that there was going to be a payment plan for lost production in herds that were officially positive for H5N1. In that initial announcement, they said that they would be paying 90% of the lost production per cow. That was pretty much the extent of the details we got at that time. Now we have a few more. So as expected, your herd has to be confirmed positive with H5N1 at the NVSL, the lab in Ames, Iowa. The cows that are eligible, they are saying, need to be initially removed from commercial milk production at some point during the 14-day time period before the sample collection date for the positive H5N1 test through 120 days after the sample collection date for the positive H5N1 test. That's a big window. 14 days before the confirmed positive and 120 days after. The cows that are eligible are the ones that were removed from the commercial milk supply at some point. And then the implication is that they were put back in. So drying off a cow does not count. So they're going to do this on a per cow basis, and they're going to calculate it based on 21 days of no milk production, followed by 7 days where they're only at 50%. So when we look at all this payment information and we look at how they're calculating it, it's a per head payment rate multiplied by the number of eligible adult dairy cows, multiplied by the producer's share in the milk production, multiplied by 90%. Looking at that, the biggest question is going to be which cows are eligible and how are they going to tell which cows are eligible? Are you going to have to produce a record of who went to the hospital pen or who spent at least one milking out of the bulk tank? How is that going to be enforced? I have no idea. We're going to have more details on July 1, and all of the details will be published in the Federal Register, but we won't have those until July 1. Enrollment also starts July 1. I'll get to those details as soon as I can. As soon as I get a chance to dig into what the details are, I will make sure that I get those out to everybody. This has the potential to be a really good program. There's some details that need to be sorted out, and until we have those, I don't think it's going to change anything from a standpoint of incentives to test. There's still too much unclear, but hopefully we have all those details and everything we need on July 1st. All right, let's move to another document. And this one is from FDA. It is an agenda and a outline of the research they're going to continue to do. And they made that public and available. And it's great to have clear communication on this point where it says, this is what we're intending to do. So we can know what it is they're going to look at and all the different things that they're testing. I like this document a lot. So in this, they have objective one. Okay, they're trying to understand the characteristics of inactivation methods for H5N1 in dairy products. When we say pasteurization is a pretty broad term, and there's all sorts of different techniques and different protocols. And this is basically made to look at all the different types of pasteurization. So they're going to do four things in this objective. They want to look at pre-pasteurization milk samples, and that's basically testing raw milk before it's pasteurized to see what is there and how much. Okay, so that's what they're looking for in that. What H5N1 is there? Looking at sequences, I'm sure. And then how much is there? So they know exactly what's going into all the different pasteurization processes. So they know what they can do on the testing side with the correct amount of virus. So in focus area two, they're going to continue benchtop studies, looking at exactly what we just talked about. Taking a set amount of virus, putting it in milk, and seeing what temperatures and times work to inactivate the virus. Focus area three is looking at continuous flow pasteurization. So it's a commercial technique rather than, let's say, a batch where you fill up a container, heat that whole container. This is a continuous flow, a little different, and they want to see if that's effective as well. So looking at continuous flow pasteurization. After that, one of the big questions that has been unanswered so far is, what about raw milk cheese? So we just have no information, right? We know the dangers of drinking raw milk. Not a good idea. Even outside of this situation, drinking raw milk is a bad idea. But there's a lot of cheese products and a lot of other countries that have raw milk cheeses. And because of the way they age them and some of the treatments they use, there's been questions about, well, maybe that's safe, maybe it's not. We don't know. So fortunately, FDA is looking at that. They're going to look at raw milk cheese and aging and see what the survivability of H5N1 is in those studies. The last objective in this FDA document is to approach everything with a One Health perspective, meaning that it's going to have to be a multifactorial approach to the prevention or control of H5N1. That means that we have to consider all the different species. We also have to consider human health, the environment, everything together in One Health. That includes for them, and specifically talking about different applications and different ways to inactivate H5N1, specifically mentioning in this document discard milk or waste milk. That's been a big issue this whole time, trying to figure out if we have other ways besides heat treatment to inactivate H5N1. We've talked about acidification being a possibility, but we don't have enough data to tell us that that's for sure going to work. We also don't have a whole lot of data to tell us what can we add to waste milk that's going to successfully inactivate the virus. Chemical additives to water, lots of data there to tell us exactly what we should add to water to inactivate H5N1. But when it comes to milk, we don't have a whole lot of data, and it doesn't translate well to use the data from water and try to use it for milk. They're just too different. All right, let's get to the main event. Minnesota Board of Animal Health put out an FAQ document that gives us the bones of what we're going to have for a control plan. So we have information about what are some of these decisions they've made about quarantines and things like that. So let's get to that document. This document went out in an email. I have not seen it on their website yet. I'm sure that'll be up soon, but we're going to go over it piece by piece just so you have the information that's in that document. So right off the bat, we're going to have some biosecurity information in this document. And we're talking about, according to the Board of Animal Health, they're going to be using a framework that has three levels of biosecurity. Those are everyday, elevated, and containment. Those are the terms they're going to use. So we have definitions basically for what those mean in this document. So the question is, what is required in everyday biosecurity on a farm? And the answer is, baseline practices include biosecurity protocols and procedures that guide day-to-day activities in and around the farm to limit the risk of disease introduction or spread, such as wearing clean clothing and footwear and separating sick animals from healthy animals. So in my perspective, we always think about biosecurity in its most heightened form, right? When we think about poultry and swine operations, we're thinking about showering in, showering out, Danish entry systems, and that's what we think of for biosecurity. Not everything when it comes to biosecurity looks like that. There are plenty of things that dairies do from a biosecurity standpoint. They just don't potentially think about them as biosecurity. Dipping teats, pre-dipping and post-dipping, are both forms of biosecurity. Washing, milking equipment is biosecurity. If you stop and think about all the things that happen on a dairy farm, you're going to realize there's plenty of things that count as biosecurity when we use the definition of limiting the risk when it comes to introduction of something and or spreading it around the farm. Scraping pens so that there's not as much manure in that pen and keeping that manure out of the bedding, that is biosecurity. So if we sat and thought about it, there'd be plenty of things on that list, but that all usually falls under everyday biosecurity. The things that allow you to operate without introducing major pathogens and or spreading them around your farm, that is biosecurity. So the next question in this document is, what is elevated biosecurity? And the answer is, this is the stage all dairy farms should be practicing in Minnesota during this disease outbreak. That's important to know. They are saying, Board of Animal Health is saying, that all dairy farms in Minnesota should be practicing elevated biosecurity. And what does that mean? That means essential traffic. Only important vehicles and equipment should come on to or leave the farm. We should be making plans for mortality disposal. Dead animals should be disposed of carefully to avoid spreading disease. If they're taken off site, the truck should limit stops and follow a specific route that avoids other farms. The truck and equipment must be cleaned before going to another farm. And then lastly, the third bullet point is manure, bedding, and waste milk disposal. Waste products like manure, bedding, and waste milk should be kept on site to prevent disease spread. If they must leave the farm, it should be done carefully to avoid contaminating other farms. Equipment used should be cleaned before going elsewhere. So basically, we're getting at some of the things that we identified in the EPI from last week. All the EPI reports identified specific routes where this could spread between farms. And part of that is shared equipment, part of that is mortality disposal, and part of that is shared personnel and or visitors. So when we look at this, essential traffic, I think we all know what that means, right? It's one of those things where we could define it a lot of different ways, but everyone has a general idea of what is essential traffic for their farm. Visitors are not included. So tours and things like that, unless your business is tied to agritourism, which some farms have that in their business plan, we could argue if that's essential, but for some farms it might be. But for most farms, visitors, tours, things like that are just not on the list of things that we should be doing right now. Salespeople and everybody else that is not essential to the operation of that farm, we can still meet. We can work with all the technology we have to do virtual meetings, which I know we're all sick of, but they work. Phone calls, meeting off the farm, somewhere else where you are limiting the amount of traffic that comes to your farm itself. Mortality disposal. This is a big one. On-site mortality disposal in the form of composting is probably number one. And then deep burial, when possible, in the summer, when the ground isn't frozen, is number two. Those are both approved methods of mortality disposal and keep access from wildlife limited. Composting would definitely be my first choice. After that, we get into this whole rendering conversation and the flow of traffic with the rendering truck. Washing the rendering truck between pickups, is that practical? Probably not. It's probably not. The rendering truck is not going to wash in between pickups unless you have a big enough pickup that you can be their only stop. But we can look at flow as well and look at, okay, if I do have an infected premise or an infected farm, at least the route of the rendering truck should go. So that is the last stop for sure. It should never visit there and then go to other farms. That is low-hanging fruit, and that is a fairly simple fix from a logistics standpoint to just say, nope, that's the last stop. It has to be. And then at the end of the day or at the end of the load, we can wash, if needed, that truck before it goes out again. When we talk about the rendering truck itself and its access to your farm, we definitely want to limit that vehicle's interaction with other vehicle routes. There's all sorts of different ways to get that done, but that is the goal. That rendering truck's route to get the animals it needs to pick up should be in a way that it doesn't cross over with other vehicle routes as much as possible, and it limits its contact with all pieces of the farm. That's the goal. Just limit access of the rendering truck to other vehicle routes and to other animals and other pieces of the farm. Routes, especially where you're going to be driving the same route to get feed and taking vehicles into the barn. There's so many different setups on dairies in different situations. That's the goal, and that's what we need to accomplish. And I'm confident that farmers can figure out how to get that done. The last piece of this, the manure and the bedding and the waste milk. You know, if you're an infected premise, then you're going to have virus in your waste milk. So if we're trying to control waste milk and where it goes, ideally it would be pasteurized in all scenarios. That is the ideal, pasteurized in some way, regardless of where it goes. If it's going to calves, if it's going to manure storage, if it's going on fields, wherever it goes, ideally it would be pasteurized. When we talk about manure, you know, I think that the big thing that we're worried about is that on the poultry side, we have good data to show that litter could be a potential source for infecting other poultry flocks if it's not handled properly. And right now they compost it in the barn, so it is free of H5N1 before it was put on fields, but it can be an infectious source. So taking that information, we have to worry about manure on our end, because manure is not just feces. It can be urine and bedding and waste milk and all sorts of things in there. How do we responsibly use that manure, which we need to use to put on fields? And how do we do it in a way that doesn't put other farms at risk? We don't have that information yet. Composting seems to be a great idea. So if you have the opportunity to compost your manure, I think that's excellent. That's a great idea. If you have the ability to hold your manure for a long time, time is your friend in this situation. So if you can hold it, great. That can help a lot. So if you have lots of storage. What I'm worried about are some of the dairies that I've worked with have expanded to a point where they have outgrown their manure storage capacity, and they've done that really quick. So they're needing to pump out daily. That scenario can be pretty problematic in this situation, especially if that farm becomes infected, because now you're having to pull out of that manure storage every day to make it work. What you do with that manure, we don't have a great solution yet. Are there additives you can put in? I don't know. The big thing is, if you're going to spread it or put it somewhere, it needs to be as far away from other livestock facilities as much as you possibly can manage. That includes other dairies. That includes beef operations, goats, alpacas, sheep, and certainly poultry. So if you're having to pull out of your manure storage frequently or on a regular basis, we got to be thinking about the logistics of where it's going to go and how to keep that as separate from other livestock operations as possible. The last piece of this that we absolutely need to make sure that we are taking care of is our shared equipment. We talked a little bit about that last week. If you're going to have contract haulers, if you're going to have shared equipment to move manure, it should be clean before entering your operation. So inspect it before it comes in and make sure it's clean. And if it's not, send it away. It should be clean before it comes to your operation if it's been anywhere else. So that goes for if it's leaving your place, you know, we'd like to make sure it's clean before it goes to the next place. So that's something that we just need to change our attitude about equipment, transportation equipment, but also manure equipment. It's just got to be clean before it goes to another operation. All right, let's finally move on to the next question. And the next question is, what is containment biosecurity? And the answer is, quote, this is the level of biosecurity used on H5N1 affected farms. These measures are to prevent the virus from spreading off farm through things like people, equipment, and waste. Board of Animal Health staff help affected producers develop a containment biosecurity plan, and protocols include entry points and cleaning procedures, proper disposal for dead animals, bedding, manure, waste milk, and garbage, movement controls for who and what can come onto or leave the farm, including livestock and products, guidelines for how supplies and feed are delivered, including who can handle them and how they're transported, communication and security policies for how biosecurity is communicated to staff and visitors and how to keep the premise secure, pest control measures to keep pests like birds and rodents away from the farm, and biosecurity of anyone coming onto the premise to collect surveillance samples, end quote. So when we look at that, there's a lot of things on that list, and we're going to get more details about this piece. There's going to be a lot more being made with specific guidelines for how to get these things done. And I'm very certain that the Board of Animal Health will have their case managers make sure that they are walking these farms through these steps so that we have containment as much as we can. Is it ever going to be perfect? No. But again, we're just trying to lower the risk and lower the amount of virus that gets spread into that shared ecosystem and could potentially impact other farms in the area of all species. Okay, if you're looking at this document while you listen, I'm going to skip a question. We'll come back to it at the very end, and we'll get back to it, I promise. The next question we're going to cover is, what do producers do if they notice any dead wildlife or barn cats around their dairy? And it's pretty simple. Contact the people that you trust to help you figure that out. Okay, so I would say contacting your veterinarian or the Board of Animal Health are great ways to start. If you notice that, you're concerned about it, you can also contact USDA Wildlife Services. Straightforward. The next question is, what is a non-negative test result? So we've been getting that question a lot. What does non-negative mean? Well, basically, when we look at the flow of how things have to work, we say non-negative for any sample that is testing positive at a NHLN lab, N-A-H-L-N lab. Nothing can be confirmed as truly positive until it is sent to NVSL in Ames. That is the lab that can call a positive with a confirmatory test. So everything else, if it's testing positive anywhere else, it is called a non-negative. That's all it means. All right, moving on to the next couple of questions. In this document, they're asking, what information do you collect from a producer after a non-negative result? So after a non-negative that is reported to the Board of Animal Health, what information do they need? They need your name and address, and they need where the affected animals are located and the premise ID number. They're going to basically get basic demographic information of your farm. Now, to follow that, the next question in this document is, does producer data remain private? That's a big question. And the answer is, quote, the only information associated with positive herds the board releases is the county where a herd is located, its size, and the species. The board has the authority to keep this information private in Minnesota, end quote. All right, the next set of questions are all about quarantine and what happens with that and what the decisions are for what they're going to do with quarantine. So the decision, if you read through the document, is that there will be, after you test positive, a quarantine issued for all susceptible species on the premise. So that means it's not just dairy cows. It is also poultry and goats and alpacas and cats, susceptible species quarantined on the premise. What does a quarantine mean? We've talked about quarantines before. It means that nothing can move unless it has permission from the board. So if you needed to move animals, you would then request a permit from the board for the specific animals you want to move and where they're going. And the board would then approve or deny that. According to this document, the quarantine is going to last at least 30 days. And later, we'll talk a little bit about how to get out of the quarantine, because they've included that information as well. Important to note, milk from infected premises can continue to be sold commercially because it's destined for pasteurization. That is important. Selling raw milk from an infected premise is a huge no. But you can still send your milk to the processor to be pasteurized. That is definitely allowed. And any of that will be handled by MDA. And you can ask the questions of those representatives that will be involved in helping you figure that out. So the question naturally next is, what happens with manure? Well, manure is handled exactly the same as animal movements. If you want to move manure, you must apply for a permit, and that will be either approved or denied by the board. Same thing with waste milk. Waste milk will be treated a little differently because you're going to have to come up with a milk handling plan. And that's going to be working through MDA to work through their documentation to help you come up with How are you going to handle waste milk? What are you going to do with it to get it treated appropriately and come up with a plan on how to move it if you need to move it off your farm? Big question listed here is, are there exceptions to the quarantine? And the large answer is no. Everything is quarantined. If you want something to move, then you need to request a permit. So just as important to all of these quarantine rules is, how do you get out? How do you get out of the box? And we've talked a lot about that. You can't have a plan to go in the box without a plan to get out. And the board has provided a plan to get out of the box. How do you get the quarantine released? And the answer is, quote, the quarantine is in place for a minimum of 30 days from the initial non-negative test result. The following testing requirements must also be met. 3 consecutive H5N1 negative bulk tank milk samples collected at least 1 week apart and tested at a non-laboratory like the U of M Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory. Additionally, all cows whose milk is being withheld from the bulk tank due to clinical signs or an H5N1 positive result must have a negative H5N1 sample collected at the same time as the 3rd negative bulk tank sample. End quote. So we've got a plan to get out of the box. That's the plan moving forward. It may be amended as we get more information. I'm really happy that we have a way out, because there's so many times where plans get put into place without that. And I'm glad that we have a definitive way to meet criteria to get out of the box. All right, we've got one more question before we get to the one I skipped earlier. The question I want to cover before we get to that is about control areas. So the question is, are there control zones placed around non-negative farms? And the answer is, quote, there are no official disease control zones placed around dairy sites because this is classified as an emerging disease and not a foreign animal disease in cattle. The board recommends enhanced biosecurity for premises with cattle and poultry located within the county and neighboring counties where H5N1 has been confirmed. End quote. So this question likely comes from what's happening in Iowa. In Iowa, they are, regardless of what the premise is and the species, if there's a positive, they are then creating a zone around that positive, certain distance, and they are mandating testing for all susceptible species and operations within that zone. That is an attempt to get more information about how this is moving around and where did it come from, and make links between premises so we can start to identify what are all the ways that this virus could be moving between locations and different operations. So I'm sure that's where that question comes from and why it's being asked in this document, so that we can get an answer from Minnesota and get their perspective. All right, let's get to that question that I skipped earlier. And the question in the document is, are producers and veterinarians legally required to report suspected disease? And the answer is, quote, yes, in both Minnesota statutes and rules. Minnesota Statute 35.06, a person who knows or reasonably suspects that a contagious or infectious disease exists in a domestic animal shall immediately notify the board. H5N1 must be reported to the board because it is a contagious disease in a domestic species. End quote. I think it's very important for everyone involved in this process to pay attention to this question. This answer to this question brings up all sorts of other questions, starting with, you know, the way this rule is written. It's really difficult to take guidance from the way this is written, because when we look at the way it's written, pretty much everything counts and should be reported based on the way this is written. Now, I don't think that's the intention or the spirit of this law, because I don't think the board wants to hear about every single ringworm case and every single mastitis and pneumonia that's out there, because that's not productive and completely unnecessary. So I think this is geared towards situations like this, where we have an emerging disease and or reportable diseases. I think one of the best ways to take any question out of this kind of situation, especially for veterinarians, is to put H5N1 on the reportable disease list. So right now, HPAI, high path avian influenza, is on the reportable disease list. So you must report suspicion of that disease to the board. But when this virus is in cattle, it's not HPAI. It's H5N1 in dairy cattle. Hopefully we'll get a better name for the disease at some point. But that would take any question out of it. Reportable diseases, no question, veterinarian must report suspicion of the disease. Hands are tied. It's just the way it is. So there's, I'm sure, a ton that goes into getting a disease on that reportable disease list. So I have no idea how possible or how quickly that could happen, but it would take all question out of this situation. All right, that's where we'll end it for today. I've talked plenty. Thank you for listening, everybody. Please, if you have comments, questions, scathing rebuttals, send them to themoosroom@umn.edu. You can call me at 612-624-3610. And please check out our website, extension.umn.edu. Thank you, everybody. Catch you next episode.